James, bring us up to date from your point of view. What do you think of this crisis that we face today, sitting here in the United States, and the so-called looming threat of America going into default? Is this a reality, or is this all simply show business?
Absolutely 100% show business. I think this is a complete game of political smoke and mirrors, and it is just being waged for obvious political reasons to help garner and to rally and consolidate support amongst the base of each party. And both parties are playing into this and making it quite the political show, but I truly do believe this is just smoke and mirrors. And I'm absolutely convinced that the U.S. will not default on its debt. And the markets may be doing whatever they're doing at the moment, going down because there's some fears that there may be some sort of crisis developing out of this. But I absolutely am convinced that this is not going to be the type of crisis that the markets are even contemplating at the moment, and that we will see things going back to business as usual as soon as this is cleared up by the end of the month. So I'm thinking that this is not the type of doomsday scenario that's being painted, and it's just another blind, cynical manipulation of people's natural fears about what's happening on the bigger scheme, and people's natural understanding that, exactly as you say, the government can't go on spending more money than it takes in forever. There has to be an end to this, and people understand that intuitively, so they're concerned about these types of situations. But I can guarantee you the U.S. is not going to default on its debt this month.
And basically, of course, you default on your debt. If you didn't have any money, they've got lots of money coming in. They're getting $2.4 trillion, something like that. I think about $2.4 trillion is coming in every year. They've got enough money to pay the debt, which is a little over $400 billion. But it's all talk, ladies and gentlemen. Your mind is being manipulated by those people who control the dancing shadows that are reality. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and here we are on Monday afternoon. We have with us James Corbett. And James, of course, is the lead editorial writer for the International Forecaster. And isn't it James is saying that he doesn't think that America is going to default on its debt? That what we're seeing is fall to all, what you're seeing is political theater, and neither political party is addressing the real issue. You cannot continue indefinitely spending money you don't have. You cannot continue indefinitely borrowing money. So you have two choices. You can either increase taxes, which nobody wants to do, or you can cut spending, which nobody wants to do. So basically, of course, the easiest thing is just to keep borrowing more and more and more money. But since all the money is created by debt, and basically you have to pay interest on that, right now, of course, we're getting by with less than 3% interest, but what happens when the interest goes to 6%, to 8%, to 10%, and the majority of the money coming into the Washington, D.C. is going to pay interest on the national debt? At that point, the whole thing collapses. I think it's going to collapse long before then, but James, you pick up the story and explain to our listeners what's going on and what should be done and certainly what you think is going to be the outcome, or is it simply going to be down the line that suddenly they'll come to some sort of agreement, and we'll just keep expanding and increasing the debt and increasing it. And the longer we put it off, the more disastrous and horrible it's going to be when this whole thing falls apart. What are your thoughts?
Well, unfortunately, I think it's exactly as you outline in that scenario. My understanding is that this is going to be a deal they're going to reach, and they may reach it at the last minute once again in order to once again ratchet up the tension and the drama. But they will reach a deal of some sort in order to increase the debt ceiling limit, and they will continue printing money and spending money as usual. And of course, as we know, the real solution to this would be not only the cutting of spending and the increasing of taxes, but the real solution, of course, would be to have a system that wasn't based on the creation of debt money, a system that doesn't rely on this constant increase in debt in order to fund the activities of the government. But of course, we know that the fundamental question of money creation is not one that's politically viably on the table for negotiation. So So I think that, once again, we're several steps removed from any type of underlying economic reality. And unfortunately, the best possible scenario would be, of course, the expansion of the economy out from underneath this debt burden, so that it really wouldn't even matter if the government was spending because the economy was expanding.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Sydney and James is saying that the real solution to the problems we face would be to expand the economy. And basically, if the economy was growing and growing rapidly enough, then we wouldn't be having the problems we are. And we'd be able to generate enough money. Sydney, we would not be going into debt, but this is not going to happen because the leaders of our country have a different agenda. The real leadership of both political parties are globalists. They want, of course, to build up the economy of China and of India and of the Middle East. They want to build up the economy in China and in Indochina. And they have. They've done a wonderful job of creating a thriving economy in China by transferring American jobs to China and to India. And all throughout the world, as we transfer our jobs overseas, we lower our tariffs intentionally aimed at eventually bankrupting America, in the process lowering the living standards of the United States, because the leaders of both political parties are not dedicated to America, but in my estimation, to this globalist dream. James, you pick up the story, and we want to know what you think can be done, what will be done, and what the future holds for the people listening to this program.
Well, Dr. Stan, you bring up such an important point there, that what really underlies all of this on both sides of the political aisle, both sides of the phony political paradigm, is that underlying agenda. And it is an agenda towards the creation of a one-world government that will be dictatorial in nature. And we've seen this time and time again from all of the various propaganda angles that they like to try to sell this to us, and they like to try to make it sound like world government is going to be a wonderful thing that will make peace and happiness on Earth for all humanity, etc., etc. But we know, of course, that the real agenda is almost the exact opposite. It is the agenda towards the creation of a government that's much more like the government of a 1984 or a Brave New World, that controls every aspect of society. So I think that we have to understand that what underlies all of the, not just the political smoke and mirrors, but the economic and financial smoke and mirrors that we talk about every week here, is that underlying agenda. And once we understand that, then I hope that it becomes more clear why, for example, I always stress that I'm not a financial advisor in this current economic paradigm. I'm an economic analyst, because I think that truly, there are ways, of course, to make money in this rigged, phony market as it exists. But I think we have to understand that our participation in the markets as they exist right now is in and of itself supporting a moral evil. And until we understand that there is a moral evil underlying the roots of the markets today, then we can continue playing along. And hey, you could make money investing in Lockheed Martin and the other military-industrial complex manufacturers, or Coca-Cola and Monsanto and the other companies that are producing the chemicals and concoctions that people are increasingly hurting people's health. Or you can invest in all sorts of other companies that are helping to undermine our liberties and freedoms. Apple with their new fingerprint sensors for their iPhone 5 and the like, that is part of the biometric control grid that's coming into place. And you can make money investing in these companies because they continue to pay out dividends. But the point is not, in my mind, to make money. The point is to create a society that will be a better society on the other side. And that's exactly why I'm not interested in being a financial advisor, and why I think people out there, I hope that people in the audience understand that there is more to life than the creation of dollars and the accumulation of dollars in your bank account, and that it has been that pursuit of the quote-unquote almighty dollar, which has truly undermined so much of our society and continues to do so on a daily basis as people become more and more obsessed with what they refer to as bling and the trappings and accoutrement of wealth. rather than actually what underlies a truly healthy society, which is not, of course, the creation of more bombs or the creation of more GMOs or monstrosities to sell to the public, but the creation of goods that people actually need and want in order to live their lives in peace and harmony. And we are so far detached from that in our current system that I think it is almost impossible to maintain any sort of leading edge in today's economy without participating in that moral evil. And that's why I think that we have to really ponder very carefully what it is that we're giving our money to and what it is we're supporting, especially if people are playing these rigged and phony markets.
Well, as you point out, there's a tremendous amount of money to be made by investing certainly in war industries, because, of course, that is the one industry. They can always create a justification for a war, whether the war would be in Libya, where we killed almost 500,000 people, according to the information we're getting. Of course, they go up on the Internet, they'll deny that, but certainly we're going to be talking to the tribal leaders from Libya who are now living in exile. I mean, remember, this is a little country, 6.5 million people. Well, we killed 500,000 people, another 2 million people at least living in exile, 3 million people living in Libyan abject poverty, American tax dollars at work. And basically, this was a comfortable, very prosperous country 3 years ago, but it's not today. It's a living hell. And I fear that one day, God is going to bring judgment on America. And the apathy and indifference of the American people will first cause terrible, terrible things to happen here. Well, basically, James, certainly, as you look and see what's going on, certainly in Japan and the Orient and in China over there, my understanding is that the economy is they're trying to stimulate the economy in Japan by lowering the value of the currency and so your goods will be more competitive in the world market. But when they do that, doesn't that destroy the value of the life savings of the Japanese people? Who are so the money is the yen. You destroy the value of the yen. You increase the yen. The whole idea was that we're going to double the number of yen in circulation, and that way, of course, the money would go down in value, and then, of course, your products would be cheaper, and then everybody would be returning to work. Is it actually being effective, this new policy put out?
Well, it not only is not being effective, they're not even at this point able to devalue the yen as much as they'd like to. In fact, the yen is gaining in value during this U.S. shutdown crisis, quote-unquote, as people are turning to the yen as a safe haven during this whole debt drama. So the yen is actually gaining in value despite the best attempts by Tokyo to lower its value. But even if they were successful, and I'm sure in the end run and in the long run they will be successful in weakening the yen, because they simply can just turn on that money spigot and continue printing as much as they want. But when and if they are successful in that task, exactly as you say, the devaluing of the yen, of course, does eat into the lifelong savings of many of the Japanese workers here, many of whom are, of course, at the age of retirement and are preparing to leave the workforce and to live off of their savings, which generally tend to be in Japanese government bonds, which, of course, are also very much at risk as the Japanese government starts to try to come to terms with its absolutely mind-bogglingly crippling debt. And we've seen the incredible amount of debt compared to the Japanese economy, the highest debt-to-GDP ratio in the developed world, just continuing to grow apace. And the recent move by the current Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe to raise the consumption tax here from 5% to 8% is in and of itself not even going to be a drop in the bucket compared to the debt levels of the country. And even if it were somehow going to substantially eat into that debt, of course, it's also going to eat into the productive economy as people scale back their discretionary spending because, of course, of the increase in tax prices. So it is just an absolutely very, very difficult situation, and it's only being made worse and exacerbated by this policy to devalue the yen.
What about China now? My understanding certainly is that although we're told that things are not so bad in China, things are doing pretty well, that they really are having certainly problems over there economically. They built all these cities, and there's nobody living in the cities. Certainly they're spending all this money that they don't have. They've created out of nothing. But basically, that actually, certainly, because of the worldwide recession, why other countries are not buying their products the way they have. And so the Chinese exports are cutting back, and certainly their wages are going up so that their products are not as competitive. And that even China, this certainly financial miracle we've witnessed, thanks in large part, of course, to the people who control America, who wanted to transfer all of our jobs over there, our manufacturing jobs, and have invested heavily in China. But even China is beginning to have some financial problems as their exports are beginning to contract. And as the prices begin going up in China itself, what do you hear? Because you're a lot closer to that than I would be.
Well, I think it's funny to watch how people keep their eye on some of the meaningless numbers coming out of China. And in fact, ZeroHedge.com put it best in a tweet that they tweeted out recently, where they noted that China's economic random number generator is still working fine, talking about the Chinese September non-manufacturing PMI, which came out at 55.4, showing a great expansion in the Chinese economy, as opposed to August's 53.9 figure. But of course, these figures are absolutely meaningless, and I think the random number generator is probably the best way to describe them. So I think we're getting a lot of hot air and completely meaningless numbers coming out of China that make it difficult for outsiders to see what's really happening in the Chinese economy. But I think that it should be quite obvious just from the surrounding economic data that, as you point out, the decrease in trade with countries like the United States, which of course are buying less from China these days, is really damaging to the Chinese economy, which does rely so much on its export ability. And as much as China has been attempting to increase and spur domestic consumption in recent years as a way of growing the economy in a more sustainable manner than the ridiculous rates of growth they've seen in previous years, I don't think that that's been particularly successful as of yet, and I think we're a long way from seeing China being able to actually meet its own demand through domestic consumption. So I think they're in a very precarious situation, and I don't think that the numbers that are coming out of China really reflect that reality.
And of course, we hear that all throughout the world, people are hoarding cash. People are not spending the way they have in the past. Certainly, more and more people are concerned. And if people aren't spending money, of course, then this tends to cause a worldwide a contraction of manufacturing, worldwide. Oh, so the contraction of the monetary system. We'll be back in just a moment here.
While the storm clouds gather all across the sea.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and James, I know you read a lot of the same things that I do, and we've seen these articles, several of them recently, about people hoarding cash. And certainly here in America, people are talking about they're hoarding about $1.8 trillion. Whether that's an accurate figure, I have no idea. I mean, we read these things, and are they true? But certainly, is this something that's happening in America? Is this something that's happening in other countries? People are certainly not as anxious just to go out and spend money as they have been in the past. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think you're exactly right. There's no way to really know if these estimates are anywhere close to reality, and how could such a figure really be accurately measured, how much cash is being hoarded. But I think that you are right, especially during these types of these times of great instability, and people are reading every day about the U.S. government shutdown and how the debt default, if it happens, could be 23 times worse than the collapse of Lehman Brothers, et cetera, et cetera. And people get, of course, very scared and nervous about this type of talk, and they wonder what they can do for their own households. So I think that hoarding cash would be something that a lot of people would be doing right now, sort of holding their cash out of the markets and out of investing to see how things shake out. And I think that makes a certain degree of sense, just given the type of people who are watching this on the sidelines, wondering what to do with their money. But of course, this is a very dangerous game to be playing during a time when so much money is being created, because of course, it really does depend so much upon the creation of extra dollars via the Federal Reserve, whether or not that money is going to hold any value in the future. And so we are seeing, of course, the incredible creation of money through the Federal Reserve's quantitative easing programs to the tune of $85 billion a month. that's being pumped into the economy, and we are not seeing the hyperinflationary death spiral starting yet, as we've talked about many times on this program, as the velocity of money is at all-time lows, meaning that the credit is not expanding, and so this money is not making its way into the productive economy and is thus not contributing to inflation. So for the time being, it seems that perhaps holding cash is not such a tenuous place to be, but I think in the long run, especially if and when this hyperinflationary tidal wave starts to consume people in the economic tsunami that's coming, it would be an exceptionally bad idea to have most of one's savings in cash. So I certainly hope that if people are hoarding cash, that they do at least contemplate how they can diversify that a little bit with some investing, for example, in commodities, of course, in precious metals, in real estate, in other tangible assets that would survive whatever type of economic tsunami might be coming.
Well, you know, James, the hardest thing, I think, is for the average individual to understand that we live in a different world. I mean, we have a world we've been raised in based upon a paper money system and a system of borrowing money and banks and everything that we've been brought up to believe is stable. And yes, you have your ups and downs, but you may have your downs, but then you have your coming back ups again. I don't think that the average individual could imagine that the system that we've lived with for all of our lives, so they could be in real danger and might actually one day simply be totally destroyed. Is this a possibility?
Yes, of course it is. And we've talked about this many times, but I've noticed also from my own work and some of the feedback that I receive that people are growing more and more cynical about this possibility of a collapse, and people are becoming a little bit more complacent because
this is Dr. Stan, and we're just talking with James about the attitude of the average individual. The average individual has been raised in with a fairly stable monetary system. Yes, in the 1950s and 60s, 40s, 50s and 60s, we had a fairly stable dollar. The dollar really didn't begin to inflate until after the 15th of August, 1971, when President Nixon temporarily suspended the convertibility of the dollar for other countries into gold. So before that, Americans couldn't hold gold, but other countries could. And basically, they could cash in their dollars and get gold for it. And then, of course, on August 15th of 1971, we had a temporary suspension of that, and that's continued until this very, very day. And, of course, we'll be talking about almost 40 years later down the line. So under any circumstances, of course, basically, but people still, you know, they still have the dollar. They look pretty much the same. And, things are quite a bit more expensive than they were. But the average individual does not believe that this whole thing system is perched on the edge of, in my estimation, a financial collapse. And basically, of course, the people who are behind this know exactly what's going on, and they fear, I think, that the American people are going to begin to wake up, and that the people in America or other countries are going to try to protect themselves. But certainly if you're in pensions, if you're in annuities, if you're in bonds, if you're in anything tied to the dollar, whatever that might be, why, of course, I think that you are in a very dangerous position. And James is saying that at least some people are beginning to look and beginning to try to figure out where we're headed and what they can do to protect themselves. I don't think most people understand when the monetary system goes down, the whole structure of society goes with it. Would that be a fair estimate?
It absolutely does, and it's unfortunate in so many ways that the generation that saw the Great Depression and the depths of what happened during that time in the 1930s is, for by and large, gone today, because I think that type of cultural memory would be very, very valuable during times like these, and especially for people who just can't even believe, can't fathom, can't bring themselves to believe that that type of collapse could occur again. And for anyone who, of course, had people in their family who had lived through that, they'll remember that that people who had lived through that tended to be much more frugal with their money and tended to be very, very cautious about not wasting things, etc. Unfortunately, after several decades of a steadily growing economy, people have become so complacent that type of mindset is just bizarre and foreign to them. And that is to our detriment, because as you say, when the economy really crashes and collapses, that's the time where a society's cultural values, etc., really come to the forefront, and people either band together in order to stick through it, or it becomes a Hobbesian war of all against all, and basically people turn into animals in the pursuit of their own, the slaking of their own needs. And unfortunately, I think just given the general cultural collapse that we've seen over the last several decades in terms of the way that people have been turned into greedy, self-serving individuals who only care about themselves and about their quote-unquote bling. Unfortunately, I do not hold a lot of hope for what would happen in the event of a large-scale collapse, and I think that we would see really a deterioration in conditions. And that's one of the things that I think we have to be working now while we have this window of opportunity to counteract as much as possible, which is another reason why I advocate any type of community participation that people can get involved in terms of helping to build up a local economy. We've talked about this before many times here on the broadcast as a viable solution, getting involved with local alternative currencies and local farmers markets and co-ops and that type of thing, which would be the type of economic institutions to survive a collapse, but it's also a great way of actually meeting the people in your community, so they're not just neighbors that you've never met and never talked to, but actual real human beings that you can relate to and hopefully that you can turn to and who can turn to you during a time of crisis, which the way I see it is almost inevitable. It's just a question of when, not if.
Well, I'm old enough to remember, especially when the people were coming to the front door to ask for food. And my mother, my dad was making $100 a month, but we always had enough food to make a sandwich for them. And so basically these people would go from door to door to get food, then leave a little mark adjacent to your doorbell to let the next people know that this was a place where people would help them. And basically there were people who were hungry, and they really did need help. I mean, this was a situation where we didn't have, certainly, all of these wonderful government programs. But then, these gentlemen, down the line, these government programs are going to fail. And there may very well be a fail in the very structure of the government as we know it. And people say that it couldn't happen, and the question is, why couldn't it? This isn't the first time we've ever had a government that was spending money it didn't have, and you can't keep doing it indefinitely. It's not a matter of if, but when, in my estimation. If you have a question at all for James, my number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Give us a call if you have a question. Well, James, certainly, as we see this whole thing unfolding, what are your thoughts, certainly, about the rest of the world? What's going on, certainly, in South America? What's going on, certainly, in Africa? What's going on in Europe? Would you pick up the story? And we want your analysis.
Well, I haven't been following South America or Africa very closely, but of course the euro and the ongoing eurozone crisis is something that I continue to keep my eye on, because that's another one of those flashpoints that I think could be the real start of a domino effect that would really have a negative effect on markets around the world. So we've been watching the euro fairly carefully over the last few months, as we've talked about before, the eurozone crisis was swept under the rug somewhat during the German electoral cycle. We're now starting to see this coming to the forefront a little bit more, and we've seen that, for example, in a recent sentiment poll about the eurozone, where it's showing that overall investor morale is dropping. It's dropped to the tune of 6.1 points in September. And so we're starting to see people starting to once again wake up to the problems, the inherent structural problems of the eurozone and this so-called sovereign debt crisis, which continues to bubble to the forefront. But we actually saw the eurozone GDP grow at 0.3% in the second quarter, which for a economy that's been mired in recession for so long is actually a great figure. So that just goes to show how dire things are in the eurozone generally. Unfortunately, I think that we will not see the continuing health of the eurozone, just given the underlying economic conditions that are happening there. And once again, we see, of course, Greece constantly on the verge of collapse and constantly needing fresh injections of bailout money. And that doesn't seem like that's going to change any time in the near future. And of course, we've also seen the recent political instability in Italy, once again bringing that country's precarious situation to the forefront. So again, there's still a lot of individual crises there, and of course also the fundamental underlying structural crisis that's happening, as once again we are it has been proven in spades once again that the idea of a regional currency is doomed to failure when you join all of these countries at the hip and make them all have the same monetary policy.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly we're talking about the European Union, and James is simply saying that this whole idea of trying to get all of these various countries over in Europe to have the same currency, well, they have a different set of values. So they, basically, the people in Southern Europe, they just love to live without working. They want all these benefits, and so they feel they're entitled to them. But difficulty is you can't do that indefinitely. You can't keep spending money you don't have. So the Germans are hardworking, and basically they're able not only to take care of themselves, but the people from socialist East Germany, and Germany has at least a stable economy, but they're draining off a great deal of the economy of Germany, so that the people in Greece and in Italy and in Portugal and in Spain and in Cyprus and other countries can live well without working for it. But unfortunately, what's happening in Greece, you're seeing very, very high employment. You're seeing 27% unemployment. You look at the youth, you're talking about 50-60% unemployment there. And more people are having to be laid off. So they have to lay people off because basically they've got to quit spending money they don't have. And nobody likes that. Everybody wants the free lunch. And ladies and gentlemen, there is no free lunch. Well, my telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But in my estimation, we're moving into very, very dangerous financial times, and you better begin making your preparations for that. James, before we go on, would you like to tell our listeners how they can subscribe to the International Forecaster and how they can get your material if they'd like to subscribe to your newsletter?
Absolutely. Well, if people are interested in the International Forecaster, it is a newsletter on matters economic and financial and political and geopolitical and social and all things in between that comes out twice a week and is 30 to 40 pages of jam-packed with information that people can use to make decisions about what the real state of the economy is, not the smoke and mirrors economy that they talk about on through the talking heads on the media. So people who are interested can go to theinternationalforecaster.com. Don't forget theinternationalforecaster.com, all one word, in order to see some of the articles that appear in that in the newsletter, and also to get an introductory copy if it's your first time subscribing to the newsletter. And of course, you can find out all the details there on the website. You can also write in for more information. You can write PO Box 7752, Winter Haven, Florida 33883. That's PO Box 7752, Winter Haven, Florida 33883. And if people are interested in my own work, I'm at CorbettReport.com. That's C-O-R-B-E-T-T report.com. And I have information on politics and economy and philosophy and history and all manner of information out there. So I hope people will turn to that as an information resource.
Well, we're told that things are really getting better here in America. The price of homes is going up. Certainly that the price of homes is up almost 12% over the past year. Isn't that a good sign? Isn't that suddenly the economy is recovering? Are we getting back to where we were before we had that fallout in 2008?
Well, unfortunately, this is just the sign that, remarkably enough, they've decided to re-blow a housing bubble, which immediately after the collapse of the housing bubble in the 2006-2007 range is just unthinkable that they would go back to this so quickly. But unfortunately, again, this is what's happening, and is happening as a direct result of government intervention, including the Federal Reserve's quantitative easing and buying of $40 billion plus of mortgage-backed securities every month. Of course, underwrites a market that is inherently not there. And of course, that represents just part of the fundamental government intervention in the markets that make this more of a command and control economy than anything resembling a free market. But I'd just like to return to something that you were talking about just earlier there, talking about how people in the Eurozone and the U.S. and other places are kind of looking for that free lunch and the handouts from government. And I would like to bring this back to that, what we were talking about earlier with that cultural transformation that we've undergone, where you were talking about your childhood and how when you were young, your family would share what you had with people who were down on their luck, share some of your food. And that was just part of what people did to help each other through times of crisis. But we have become so detached from that because of the rise and the creation of this social security nanny state in which we are now expected at all times to turn to the government for help. It should be the government. What is the government doing? What government programs? What government handouts exist? How can we tax people more to fund these government programs? Because without government programs, how would any poor people be able to eat? How would people survive without food stamps? Because we have been so fundamentally detached from the idea of people actually coming together to help their neighbors individually without the threat of government coercion or the threat of them going to jail if they don't want to pay their taxes to fund the American war machine or what have you. Without that, how would people possibly come together to provide each other with food or to provide each other with the sustenance they need when they're down on their luck? Well, again, that just shows how completely we've been detached from our fundamental cultural values, which we used to have and we used to understand. And this, again, has been the result of this drastic government intervention in every aspect of people's lives, to the point where people truly believe from the bottom of their heart that without a government providing these handouts that come, of course, at the cost of the incredible debt burden, there would be no way for poor people to survive. And that is very much to our detriment, because once again, the more people get hooked on this system, the more manipulable those people are, because they can get manipulated into playing these political games that ultimately, as we've talked about before, only lead in one direction, and that is towards the creation of the global government. If we can detach people from that, if we can reacquaint them with the cultural values that we've had in our society for centuries preceding this, that people should come together and help each other during times of crisis, then we can start towards the path that I think is the real right path to be on, which doesn't have anything to do with government programs or government handouts, and everything to do with people coming together on a community level to sustain one another. And I hope that part of our mission can be to reacquaint people with those fundamental values that are light years apart from the moral evil that we've talked about that pervades these markets.
And of course, as I pointed out before, when I first went into medicine, why? Because everybody in America could get health care. Everybody could get health care, basically. If you didn't have any money, why, of course, you can go to the county hospital. Every county had a county hospital where you could get the free medical care, or you could pay what you could afford. And if you didn't have any money, but you had a home, they'd put a lien on your home. And when you died, why, they'd use that money from the home basically to pay back the money you borrowed from the local community. And, of course, it was fraud. Crooked local politicians who would buy up these homes certainly at a discount for themselves certainly and profit from it. But we have an imperfect society because we have imperfect human beings, but certainly nobody went without certainly medical care. And now a new system, why, we've come up with this wonderful new affordable health care, but there's about 8 million people who make too much money to qualify for Medicaid, and certainly not enough to get the free medical care. And basically, these are people, about 8 million of them, predominantly black. They're going to be without medical care, and there's just no way they can get it in the existing system. And basically, there's no way the government can get a system that works perfectly. We had a perfect system before when we did not have the federal government involved. Now the federal government is involved. Heaven help those 8 million people, because the attitude of doctors, of hospitals, of everyone has changed. And now medicine is no longer a noble profession, it's a business. That's exactly what they want, a business, of course, where doctors are paid and hospitals are paid. And the patient is simply part of a system, but if they can't pay, they're in real trouble. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, when this whole house of cards comes down, why we've lost that vision that one time made America the envy of the world. Let's go to Linda on the line. Hi, Linda. How are we doing?
Just fine, Dr. Stan. I want to thank you and Agnes Klubik. I used to listen to Bob Chapman on the and subscribe to his international forecaster, and it was excellent. I recommend that. I'd also like to say that my grandparents, they were in the Great Depression, and as a result, they had chickens, which were wonderful, and they had like a small truck farm where they had corn, and it was the best food. It was non-GMO, definitely. It was the very best food. But the question I had for James is, I was wondering if you could comment on the fact that a lot of these mortgage securities have been bundled and sold to people like in China. And do you think there's a chance that the Chinese could come over here and just, if we go bankrupt, make good on the claims, they just come and take your house? That's my question.
Well, that is a good question. Certainly, the mortgage-backed securities are being just bungled together and sold off to bidders around the world. And I think that China is one of those places where mortgage-backed securities are sold. But I think that what it does is create a very difficult path towards understanding the ownership of various properties, because they've been bundled together, and there's different tranches, etc., in these deals, and you have to if there's some sort of default, then you write off certain parts of the mortgage-backed security. It becomes very difficult to understand who actually owns a property. And that's something that we saw during that mortgage gate scandal that happened a few years ago, where people were being foreclosed on, and it wasn't clear if the people who were foreclosing, the banks that were foreclosing, even owned the property anymore, because of the ways that they'd sold off and bundled the securities backed by the mortgages. So I think more so than Chinese coming over and foreclosing on properties, I think that the real danger here is that we have really lost track and lost control of clear title of a lot of the properties that are out there. So it's really up in the air who owns some of these properties. And unless the government comes along and simply makes some sort of decree about where the rightful ownership lands, I think there's a lot of confusion over that. And that's only exacerbated by this practice of bundling these securities together. So I think it is a big problem. And I see the real danger being if there's another crisis that results in a lot of foreclosures, I think that basically the corrupt court system is going to be siding with the banks in every case, and a lot of people are going to be thrown out of their homes unnecessarily. And again, it sounds ridiculous, but we actually saw that during that mortgage gate fiasco, where banks that even didn't actually own the properties were trying to foreclose on people who lived there and who had actual title to the property. So it can happen, it has happened, it is happening, and it could certainly happen again, especially if and when the market falls out of this mortgage market.
And I have actually been reading about this. You know, of course, we hear that a lot of people now are buying up homes, but who are these people who are buying up homes? Well, apparently a lot of people are buying up homes as speculations, and they're simply buying them up and renting them out. And I've heard, and perhaps James better answer this than I am, but about 1 in 10 homes being bought up in the United States is being bought up by Chinese investors. Large investors are coming over because they want to get out of dollars into something of tangible value. An American home is a lot better than a worthless paper dollar that has nothing behind it. Have you heard that, Sidney James?
I haven't heard that specifically, but it certainly wouldn't surprise me. And I think we should cast our minds back to 2007, when the Bush administration was openly urging China's central bank to buy more government-backed mortgage bonds in the face of the mortgage collapse that took place then. So again, it is certainly something that's happening, that foreign investors are buying a lot of these mortgage-backed securities. And that does create some big questions about, you know, who really owns the country.
Linda, anything else to ask before we let you go?
Well, I just make one comment. I don't remember exactly where I saw the video, but it was saying how the Chinese had so much money and they were looking for hard assets, and they actually had built huge shopping centers in China, very modern, and there were no renters and no people, but people were just doing it for investment because they had so much cash. And I've also heard cities over there that have been built with no inhabitants.
But it works pretty well for a time, but sooner or later you got to pay the piper, and I think you're absolutely right. God bless. Let's go to... We've got Joseph calling from Georgia. Again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Joseph, question or comment?
Yeah, how you doing, Dr. Stan? Just a quick question. what chance do you give on of them getting rid of Obamacare come 2014 once people it sinks in how much their premiums are going to go up, and it's like the federal government just taking out of your bank account or your check. You know, that's it. To me, it's a big deal. It ain't even about health care, but what's the chances of once it sinks in, people actually voting people out, you know, checking on their voting record or even recall elections like they've done to those state reps in Colorado over the gun control stuff?
What are your thoughts, Cindy? Do you have any thoughts about perhaps Obamacare being repealed down the line?
I do. I certainly hope that it is. I'm not generally hopeful that that government policies once instituted will be repealed, because generally they tend to be set in stone. But I think that the caller is right here. I think that they have really vastly underestimated how angry people are going to be when they really start seeing how Obamacare starts to affect their bottom line and the types of expenses that it introduces to the system. And I think there will be genuine outrage at this. Growing through 2014. But interestingly enough, Mike Adams of Natural News just had a very interesting article talking about how Obamacare is doomed to fail, not necessarily because of the economic concerns or the political concerns, but because of technical concerns. And we've seen the kind of ridiculous situation in the last week where people have been unable to actually use the online Obamacare exchanges because the web forms are all broken and 99% of applications can't even be processed at this time. So the idea that this is going to roll out as expected in 2014 is looking less and less likely. So hopefully, at any rate, this will fail for one reason or another. And if it doesn't, I think you're right. The type of outrage this will provoke at the ballot box will make sure that someone along the line politically will repeal this because of that outrage.
Okay, anything else, Joseph?
Yeah, just one other thing. This cap and trade, the carbon credit, that's going to take a lot of money out of people's pockets, you know, raise their energy costs, electric bill ain't number one. So people's looking at having a lot less money. To me, it's just going to knock the economy down. If people's paying more for all this health care and energy, how are they going to spend to get a mortgage or even buy a new car or anything else, you know?
I think we're in for some difficult times, and I think that certainly James would probably agree with that. Any thoughts on that, James?
Well, unfortunately, yes, cap and trade, once again, just another vector of attack that the globalists love to use, because, of course, it means that humanity is the problem. We are just guilty for the original sin of producing carbon dioxide. So so I guess we all have to pay our penance, and we have to pay it, of course, to people like Al Gore and the other priesthood of this carbon economy. And, of course, it's all ridiculous. It's all smoke and mirrors. And, again, the IPCC just released a new fifth assessment report that supposedly 95% certain that mankind is causing global warming. But the more people look into that and where the numbers come from, the less sense it actually makes. And I've got a weekly series that I'm producing at the moment looking at the fraud behind this global warming myth. So I hope people aren't buying into it and will give the same type of opposition that they will to Obamacare.
And there's so many things we just are not getting the truth about. If they're lying to us, CO2 is absolutely essential for a healthy planet. We'll be back in just a moment. Thanks for calling, Joseph. We'll be right back.
While storm clouds gather.
Well, James, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program. You go right ahead.
Well, once again, I'd just like to stress that I think that as much as what we're dealing with is political and economic and financial in nature, I think it's equally and perhaps even more fundamentally cultural and moral in nature. And just like people like to talk about trickle-down economics, I think that we should be looking at the idea of trickle-down morality. And as the morality of the people in the positions of power becomes more and more depraved and more detached from those cultural values that we once held dear, unfortunately, the population tends to take that on and tends to mimic that. So we're seeing more and more people descending into just crass self-interest and only caring about themselves and basically allowing the economy and the people around them to rot as a result. Because once again, we've been steeped in this idea of the nanny state and that government should be the ones to take care of us all. And so I hope that we can detach people from that, that we can show them that that there used to be an economy that was built around people helping each other rather than waiting for mommy or daddy government to come along and wipe their nose for them. And I think that we have to return to those values if we want any chance to survive the types of economic cataclysm that is being engineered right now. And we shouldn't be so naive to believe that this is coming about just willy-nilly. This is happening because of a plan, an agenda that is unfolding, that is going to push us towards global government. We are seeing the beginnings of that, of course, in places like Europe, where the European Central Bank is gaining more and more power over the European economy in the wake of the Eurozone crisis. And the exact same ideas are on board for North America and the growing North American Union, the merging of the North American Union with Atlantic, the European Union, and all of these ideas are out on the table. And of course, we're seeing the beginning of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or the end of the Trans-Pacific Partnership talks this year. So it's a very, very difficult time, and I just hope that people will concentrate once again on the morality of the situation and how we have to come together as human beings to help out our fellow men and brothers and sisters who are in times of need.
God bless. Thanks very much, James. We'll talk to you again next week at the same time.
Thank you.